content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service.
And this is the August 2023 edition of Education Today.
The first article comes from U.S. News and it's titled, Office for Civil Rights Pressured to Root Out Racial Disparities After Supreme Court Ruling. By Lauren Camara, posted August 1st. The Education Department's Office for Civil Rights is facing new pressure to investigate and step up its enforcement of racial disparities in K-12 and higher education in the wake of a recent Supreme Court ruling that banned the use of race in college and university admissions. The top Democrat on the House Committee on Education and the Workforce urged Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights Catherine Lehman on Tuesday to use the full force of her office to tackle everything from exclusionary discipline to de facto segregation in poor-performing schools, from the under-education of students of color based on lack of access to advanced courses and high-qualified teachers to the use of standardized testing in college admissions and the preferential treatment in admissions granted to athletes and children of alumni, donors and faculty and staff. Any honest assessment of the pervasiveness of race in that system would recognize that people of color consistently face unequal discriminatory treatment on the basis of their race, treatment that has been historically counterbalanced by affirmative actions, but now can only be eliminated with robust enforcement of Title VI, Rep. Bobby Scott, Virginia Democrat and longtime education and civil rights advocate, wrote Tuesday in a letter obtained by U.S. News. The Office for Civil Rights has the power to conduct investigations without an intervening complaint, and I encourage you to use it strenuously to root out vestiges of discrimination in our education system, he wrote. The Supreme Court overturned decades of precedent in June when it issued a pair of decisions that struck down the use of race in college admissions. The decisions all but guarantee a drop in enrollment of Black and Hispanic students in the country's most elite colleges and universities at a time when those schools are trying to increase diversity. The watershed moment comes as the country grapples with entrenched divisions over the historic impact of systemic racism and institutions of higher education struggle to expand access to students of color in the wake of a once-in-a-generation pandemic that decimated their enrollment. Among the myriad responses to the ruling, President Joe Biden proposed new admission standards for colleges and universities to adopt, a process that takes into account the adversity. The Office for Civil Rights opened an investigation last week into whether Harvard University provides preferential treatment in the admissions process to applicants with ties to wealthy donors and alumni, so-called legacy applicants, that overwhelmingly benefits white students. And the Education Department hosted a Higher Education Equity Summit, which highlighted the various ways colleges are attempting to ensure diversity on campus with policies that, for example, may take into account things like poverty, employment, and crime rates associated with an applicant's zip code. Lehman also publicly announced that the Civil Rights Office plans to release guidance this month outlining the federal civil rights obligations that schools, colleges, and universities must still uphold in the wake of the Supreme Court ruling. But many, including Scott, consider guidance an inadequate response, especially, he said, given that some Republicans are adopting a broad interpretation of the court's ruling and attempting to apply it to circumstances beyond the scope of the decision. The Missouri Attorney General, for example, recently warned municipalities and public colleges and universities that the Supreme Court's decision means that decisions and policies about scholarships, academic programs, and employment that result in racial diversity may violate Title VI. And 13 state attorneys general issued a letter to the CEOs of the Fortune 100 companies, putting them on notice that diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts may amount to over and pervasive racial discrimination that violates both state and federal law. Title VI of the Civil Rights Act ensures that no person is excluded from participating in, denied the benefits of, or is discriminated against based on race, color, or national origin in any program that receives federal financial assistance, as nearly every K-12 school, college, and university does. It is clear that the intent of Title VI is being perverted by extreme Republicans in an attempt to roll back progress towards racial equality, Scott wrote, noting that the country has made only incremental progress since it was first enacted in 1964. Title VI has the potential to bring equity to our schools, and in turn make our society more equitable, he wrote. But the long campaign to weaken Title VI was successful. It has now taken a new, darker posture, as we witness attempts to use the law to perpetuate racial inequity.
The next article comes from Education Week, and it's titled Another AI Issue for Schools to Know About: Bias Against Non-Native English Speakers, by Ileana Naharro, posted August 10, 2023. As educators continue to explore what role artificial intelligence tools should or could play in the classroom, some researchers are cautioning teachers that AI detectors are biased against non-native English speakers. In an article published last month, Stanford University researchers wanted to evaluate how accurate detectors of GPT, or generative pre-trained transformers, are when it comes to determining whether text authored by non-native English speakers was AI-generated or written by a human. To test this, the researchers ran essays written by Chinese students for the test of English as a foreign language, or TOEFL, through 7 widely used detectors. They did the same with a sample of essays written by U.S. 8th graders who were native English speakers. The tools incorrectly labeled more than half of the TOEFL essays as AI-generated, while accurately classifying the 8th grade essays. We found this substantial bias whereby many of non-native English speakers' writings are mistakenly flagged as generated by GPT, when they were really written by humans, said James Zhou, one of the co-authors of the article and an assistant professor of biomedical data science at Stanford University. GPT detectors look at something called perplexity of text, Zhou said. Low perplexity text involves using more common, generic words that aren't very surprising and thus are more likely to be flagged as AI-generated even if that isn't the case. The researchers looked into the perplexity of the students' writing samples for this reason and found that text with low perplexity was more likely to be flagged as AI-generated. Students in the U.S. who are English learners may be more likely to use more common words in their writing as they work to expand their vocabulary, making them more likely to be erroneously flagged as having used AI, Zhou added. How to address bias in AI detectors? Bias in AI tools isn't a new phenomenon, and GPT detectors have never been 100% foolproof, especially as AI technology continues to advance, said Christopher Doss, a policy researcher at the RAND Corporation. AI is trained on data. Societal biases are baked into data, Doss said. For Doss and others, the key takeaway is that teachers must be cautious when relying on GPT detectors to determine if a student cheated with AI assistance, but more importantly, that educators need to be thinking of different ways to use AI tools in the classroom. In the beginning of the class, how do you figure out how to use ChatGPT to help learning and teach children how to use these tools for good? Doss said, but then also, how do you make sure that your children don't use it as a crutch? Peter Galt, the executive director and co-founder of Quill, a nonprofit that provides open-source literacy materials to teachers, said that the group's AI detector known as AI Writing Check was among the tools examined by the Stanford researchers. That tool is no longer available to teachers as of this week. When we launched this tool in January 2023, the only generative AI tool available was ChatGPT. There are now a series of different tools available, and each of these tools is being upgraded weekly. As these tools make their AI more complex, the AI text output becomes more varied, and it becomes more difficult for algorithms to detect whether a piece of writing was generated by AI. Read a statement on the AI Writing Check website. As a more reliable means to check for whether students used AI in their work and avoid the risk of biases in AI tools, Galt recommends teachers use students' version histories of text. In other words, teachers can go into Google Docs or Microsoft Word and see the various edits and revisions students make in their writing. Those iterations allow teachers to tell if a student was using AI assistance and also better understand their students' writing process to know how to best help them grow their writing skills. Looking ahead, Galt said advancements in technology could lead to developing AI assistance to help students as they're writing and check their work as they go rather than wait until they complete an assignment. Zhou, the Stanford researcher, also recommends this more proactive approach to checking students' writing in progress as opposed to relying on an evaluation tool at the end. With English learners in particular, he added, AI tools have the potential to help track students' grammatical mistakes for more personalized assistance and could even aid students in need of translation services. The biases against English learners in general. English learners are one of the fastest-growing student demographics in the United States. When it comes to working specifically with English learners, educators must be cognizant of broader biases these students face in K-12 schools, said Zylan and Cruz Gonzalez, the deputy director of Californians Together, a research and advocacy organization for English learners and their families. For instance, while there are clear federal guidelines and even some state guidelines on the rights English learners have in schools, whether it's access to translation services or the ability to enroll in schools regardless of immigration status, some school districts at the local level may not always understand their legal obligations, Cruz Gonzalez said. It's partly why in June the U.S. Departments of Justice and Education published fact sheets reminding educators of immigrant students' legal rights in K-12 schools. Cruz Gonzalez said English learners often face unconscious biases among educators when it comes to the linguistic and academic assets they bring to the classroom. As new technologies emerge, she and other advocates hope developers address biases in AI tools and create opportunities for English learners to creatively and positively engage with AI technology.
The next article comes from the New York Times, and it's titled, How a Sexual Assault in a School Bathroom Became a Political Weapon. It was an explosive claim that a Virginia school district covered up a crime in order to protect transgender rights. But was it true?
Written by Charles Homans. Read by Robert Petkoff. For months, a sort of aerosolized fury had hung over the Loudoun County School District. There were fights over COVID closures and mask mandates, over racial equity programs, over library books. Now, in the weeks before the school board's meeting on June 22, 2021, attention had shifted to a new proposal, Policy 8040, which would let transgender students choose pronouns, play sports, and use bathrooms in accordance with their declared gender identity. In May, an elementary school gym teacher announced that as a servant of God, he felt he could not follow the policy. The district swiftly suspended him, and just as swiftly, the antennae of conservative media outlets and politicians swiveled toward Loudoun County. The entire Republican ticket for that fall's statewide elections made a pilgrimage to Loudoun, a swath of Washington exurbs in northern Virginia that is the highest median income county in America, and the fourth most populous in the state. Fox and Friends broadcast live from a local diner. This won't stop in hashtag Loudoun County, the Family Foundation of Virginia, a conservative religious organization in Richmond, tweeted. It's coming to your schools and children, too. County Democrats urged supporters of the proposed policy to make their own voices heard at the upcoming meeting, and everyone descended upon the school administration building in the town of Ashburn. Inside, the room looked like Facebook come to life. There were mama bears and dads in tactical-themed leisure apparel and signs proclaiming solidarity with We the Parents. There were rainbow flag face masks and Black Lives Matter t-shirts and buttons affirming the many other tenets of yard sign liberalism. It was rare that the warring ideological tribes of suburbia actually met each other on an offline field of battle, and TV crews were on hand to document the occasion. That meeting, Beth Bartz, a member of the school board at the time, later recalled, just went to hell. During the public comment period, a Republican former state legislator accused the board of teaching children to hate others because of their skin color and forcing them to lie about other kids' gender. When the crowd, which had been warned against disruptions, cheered, the board voted to end public comment. The crowd booed loudly. A man in the third row stood and extended both middle fingers at the board members, who were hastily ushered into a secure back room. Scanning the scene for signs of trouble, a sheriff's deputy named Timothy Iverson saw a middle-aged man in a plumbing company t-shirt arguing over a row of chairs with a woman wearing a top emblazoned with a rainbow heart. "You're a bitch," the man said, clenching his fist. Iverson grabbed him by the arm, but he resisted. Another deputy rushed in, and the two officers tackled the man, crashing through chairs. The second deputy punched him several times. A third knelt on his back. Pinned beneath the deputies, the man screamed that he couldn't breathe. His mouth was smeared with blood. The man's wife stood nearby. "My child was raped at school," she shouted, "and this is what happens." After the deputies arrested the man and loaded him into their van, his wife explained the situation. Their names were Scott and Jessica Smith, and they owned a small plumbing business in Leesburg, a nearby town. Weeks earlier, their 15-year-old daughter was sexually assaulted by a boy in a girls' bathroom at her high school in Ashburn. The boy was wearing a skirt. "I wasn't even concerned about the fact that it was a boy wearing a skirt in the girls' bathroom at the time," Scott Smith later told me. "I'm focused on the fact that my daughter just got raped." On the day of the assault, he went to the school and erupted at the principal. A sheriff's deputy assigned as the school resource officer escorted him out of the building. After that, Smith found himself subject to what seemed to him to be a series of escalating affronts. When Loudoun County Public Schools sent an email later that day to Stonebridge families to inform them of an incident there, it was about Smith's outburst and made no mention of a sexual assault. At the June 22nd school board meeting, Smith said, "The woman he was confronting when the deputy grabbed him, a mother whose daughter had been in a Girl Scout troop led by his wife, had called him a liar and threatened to ruin his plumbing business on social media." The school authorities, too, seemed to deny that the assault occurred at all. "Do we have assaults in our bathrooms or locker rooms regularly?" Bartz, the school board member, asked when the board reconvened later that evening in an empty chamber and discussed the transgender policy. "To my knowledge, we don't have any record of assaults occurring in our restrooms," Scott Ziegler, the school's superintendent, replied. But Ziegler knew there was an investigation underway into the assault of Smith's daughter, and he had notified the school board members. In time, Smith came to believe that he knew why all this happened. So did Smith's many champions in conservative media and Republican politics. The assault of his daughter, they would argue, revealed a hidden architecture of power, the power that liberal elites had accrued in the school system of Loudoun County and counties like it all over the country. They were wielding that power to force bewildering cultural changes upon not just schools, but American society as a whole through measures like Loudoun County's proposed Policy 8040. It was clear, Scott Walker, the Republican former governor of Wisconsin, wrote about the Loudoun County episode in a 2022 Washington Times op-ed, that the school board and administrators were more concerned about furthering their transgender agenda than protecting the safety of students. The particulars of Smith's daughter's case, an attacker in a skirt, a girl's bathroom, posed an obvious threat to the new policy. And so, critics charged, school officials buried it, and because they buried it, more harm was done. When it all came to light months later, this theory of the case would galvanize a local conservative parents' rights movement, help swing a governor's race, and rattle the politics of gender in America far beyond Virginia. This was one version of the story of Loudoun County. But as prosecutors took up the matter over the next 2 years, a different story began to take shape, one that is told here based on court records and testimony, as well as months of interviews with participants in the events at the heart of the scandal, in some cases discussing them on the record for the first time, and hundreds of pages of documents obtained through public records requests. This evidence presents a much more complicated picture of what happened in Loudoun County and beyond in a period of escalating culture wars that have consumed the same communities and institutions that the combatants insist they want to save.
And we'll have to cut that article short for time.
The next article comes from NBC News, and it's titled, "With Students Back in Classrooms, Schools Work to Deal with Ongoing Heat." In Phoenix, which recorded daily highs at or above 110 F for 31 consecutive days in July, daily heat index is carefully monitored by schools. By Nidhi Sharma, Dana Griffin and Ashley Trujillo. Posted August 11, 2023. Following the hottest July on record, school districts in some of the most sweltering cities in the United States are preparing to start the academic year while working to keep their students cool and ready to learn. In Florida's Lee County School District, which welcomed students back August 10 amid record-breaking heat, following strict heat index guidelines helps keep students safe, said Irma Lancaster, director of communications. Heat index is the relative humidity combined with air temperature. At a heat index of 91 degrees Fahrenheit to 103 F, physical outdoor activity time is cut in half and students are provided with a water break every 10 minutes. At a heat index of 104 F to 125 F, students are moved to cool areas and outdoor events are likely to be rescheduled. We don't like to go off the temperature, Lancaster said. We like to go off of what it feels like, because that's really what our kiddos will be feeling. In Phoenix, which recorded daily highs at or above 110 F for 31 consecutive days in July, daily heat index is also carefully monitored by schools, said Michael Manley, chief financial officer of the Phoenix Elementary School District, which opened classrooms during the first week of August. Under certain heat index conditions, students are restricted from outdoor activity and teachers stay on high alert for signs of heat stress in students. Kelly Turner, an associate professor of urban planning and geography at the University of California, Los Angeles, said physical movement and unstructured free time are necessary components of learning. At Dunbar Elementary School in downtown Phoenix, hot days mean having free time to use the school's air-conditioned science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics laboratory. The school also offers planned activities, such as dancing, games, and more, in its gymnasium on extreme heat days. Once it gets hot outside, students choose the activity that suits them best, said Crystal Femania, a teacher at Dunbar Elementary School. Having those choices for them and having activities that they enjoy doing is great for us all. It makes the students excited, it makes the teachers excited, and it makes school fun. Hot classrooms can be detrimental for both student health and education. One 2020 study published in the journal Nature Human Behavior, covering 12,000 school districts, found that testing conditions above 80 F negatively affected standardized test scores. Another 2023 study by the Environmental Protection Agency found that projected global temperature increases due to climate change could reduce annual academic achievement for students, and even impact their future income. If kids don't feel well or are angry or can't concentrate, then of course they won't test well, Turner said. Children's bodies are not the same as adults. They are more vulnerable to extreme heat. For many other school districts, coping with extreme heat can be difficult. Lack of adequate air conditioning is a serious issue, with one 2020 assessment by the Government Accountability Office finding that more than 36,000 schools in the U.S. public school system need to update their heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems. In central Louisiana, Rapides Parish School District spent the summer evaluating its HVAC systems to make appropriate repairs for keeping students cool, Superintendent Jeff Powell said in an interview with NBC affiliate Kalb TV. In July, temperatures in the school district were up to 10 F higher than average, hovering in the high 90s into the 100s. Many schools across the country have facets that retain heat, Turner said. Asphalt-covered schoolyards and artificial turf grass act as heat absorbers that raise the overall air temperature. Many schools are also low-lying, single-story buildings with little to no tree cover or green spaces, she said, and thus provide very little shade for students. In a policy brief for California lawmakers, Turner and her colleagues outlined several steps schools should take to help adapt to extreme heat, including planting more trees and creating green spaces, implementing indoor air temperature standards, and installing shade structures. Extreme heat is our new reality, she said. Hot seasons will be longer and more intense, and for many children, school is the only place with air conditioning. It's something schools are going to have to contend with more and more.
The next article comes from USA Today, and it's titled, We're Just Trying to Feed Kids. School Cafeterias Face Budget Cuts, Forcing Higher Prices, by Kayla Jimenez, published August 9, 2023. On a plane in July, Nicole Melia traveled from Philadelphia to Denver to meet with other school nutrition directors from across the nation about challenges they expect when the new school year begins. There was one conversation she expected to be the focus of the convening. Many schools are hiking the cost of lunches and breakfasts for kids this fall. Between inflation and the end of a short-lived boost in additional federal subsidies for every school meal, it seemed inevitable, she said. On top of that, the federal government could soon force schools to serve healthier meals with less salt and sugar, which can make them more expensive to prepare and serve. These meals could require more freshly prepared food items and staff to cook from scratch. It's really like doing Sudoku on your plate to make sure we're meeting nutrition standards, meeting the budget constraints and meeting kids' palates, said Melia. The higher prices coming to her Great Valley School District in the fall could lead families at the six schools to find lunch elsewhere, she said. Lately, I feel like we've just been getting punched in the face on a regular basis, and we're just trying to feed kids. Jennifer Bove, Food and Nutrition Director for East Hampton Public Schools in Connecticut. And if last school year was any indication, families who send their kids through their school's lunch line yet can't afford the costs but don't qualify for free meals could leave school systems to foot the bill. That scenario is expected to play out across the country. Price increases for school meals are set to take effect in districts including the Nassau County School District in New York, the Canyon Independent School District in Texas, and the Moore County Public School District in North Carolina. End of subsidies. Beginning of meal prices hikes. The federal government reimburses public schools for meals they serve to kids who qualify for free and reduced-price lunches and snacks based on income level. During the pandemic, Congress passed the Keep Kids Fed Act, which increased the amount the federal government pays schools for lunch by 40 cents and for breakfast by 15 cents for the 2022-23 school year. The aid expired June 30. School leaders hoping the financial help would continue are now working to whittle their budgets to stay out of the red. Lately, I feel like we've just been getting punched in the face on a regular basis, and we're just trying to feed kids, said Jennifer Bove, a food and nutrition director for East Hampton Public Schools in Connecticut. Many schools already experienced crippling school lunch debt since returning from the pandemic, said Diane Pratt-Hevner, a spokeswoman for the School Nutrition Association. Schools in America accrued $19.2 million in unpaid meal debt by November 2022 with a median of $5,164 per school, according to a national survey of school nutrition directors. Melia said debt in her school district has doubled from what it usually would be since schools reopened after remote teaching. The School Nutrition Association, which represents more than 50,000 people who work on school meals across the nation, is urging the federal government to act. School meal programs need permanent reimbursement rate increases to cope with long-term, higher labor costs, especially as many schools still struggle with labor shortages and need to raise wages to fully staff their kitchens, Pratt-Hevner said. In addition, federal legislation granting all kids nationwide free school meals lapsed last September. That led to a 23% drop in the number of kids eating school lunches during 2022-23. Federal survey results show, and we'll have to cut that article short for time.
We've run out of time for this episode of Education Today. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.